Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we are answering your listener questions.
That's right, Joel. This is an Ask How to Money episode where we're going to take listener questions. We've got five great ones to get to this episode, including we've got a listener who basically wants our blessing when it comes to his house hacking pursuits. We're going to get to that one. We're going to talk about warehouse clubs, which ones make sense for you. And we've got a question, too, from a listener who is wondering if he is investing too much of his money. That's not a problem that many people encounter, but he is trying to figure out the right balance of investing for himself. I'm looking forward to maybe a more nuanced conversation that you and I will have, which I feel like we try to bring that to every episode, to every question that we have. We try to bring a nuanced answer. We're never like, oh, 100%, that's totally stupid. It depends on a lot of things, right?
Yeah, a lot of people in the personal finance space are. They assume, I heard a quote, or there was a quote from Morgan Housel, who we've had on the show before, Matt. And he says that, you know,
genius thing did he say?
Exactly. He says a lot of genius things. He says that, you know, our worldview makes up 0.00003% of, you know, what's happened in the entire world. But we assume that everyone, you know, 80% of people have a similar experience to us. And it's just not true, right? Like, so our worldview colors a lot. But we try to take a step back and assume that everyone comes from a different place, from, you know, different educational background, from different money habits growing up. And so, yeah, we want to give the broadest application of the stuff we're talking about to as many people as possible. And it's going to differ from situation to situation.
That's true. But what if we're talking to somebody who sounds like us? And it sounds like, oh, yeah, I could see myself in that situation.
If they also say the word dude quite a bit.
Then maybe it's not like 0.0002. It's like, maybe it's 0.02. I don't know.
Or if they live in Atlanta, it's like, all right, we got some more similarities.
There's even more overlap.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. Well, dude, before we get to the, speaking of dude, so over the summer, I got a parking ticket. Long story short, I was in a hurry to get to an Atlanta United match, decided to go last minute, saw an open parallel spot on the side of the road. I'd never parked there before, but I was like, I'm going to go for it. I'm going to park there. Parked there. After the match came out, there was a ticket on my windshield. And I was so pissed because I had looked around and there were no parking signs that I could see. But when I came back, I was pretty furious.
I was going to say, they put up a no parking sign. Right.
No, I mean, I would have half expected that. But I looked way down the road. I'm talking like 40, 50 feet from where I was parked, there's a no parking sign. And it's not like there was an arrow, because oftentimes when they've got the arrow, they let you know, okay, on this side of the sign.
Was the curb painted?
No, the curb was not painted.
Okay.
And so because of that, I thought I had a good had a good argument. And so I took a bunch of pictures because I had heard that you can contest these tickets, at least here in Atlanta. So I snapped a bunch of pictures. I showed where my car was and how far that sign was. And you can even see the front of it because it was turned, but it was way, way, way back behind me. All that being said, I've received a notice and they're like, sorry, based on your evidence, we cannot drop this ticket. Please pay us $25. And it's not a big deal, right? $25.
Oh, I thought you were going to take this all the way to the Supreme Court, Matt.
That would be a cheap move because it would not be worth my time. $25 is not a huge deal. If it was $250 or $2,500, I would definitely be there. But for $25, whatever, I'm just going to pay it. But I just wanted to mention that because if you find yourself in a situation like that, especially in a circumstance where you might be able to overturn that ticket or have that ticket dropped before you move your car, snap some pictures, right? We've got these phones in our pockets, and I think that's a good way to document that we were perhaps in the right. And again, in this case, I was not in the right. I was parked illegally. So it turns out I was actually parked at the beginning of a bridge.
Oh.
Not like a bridge like you're thinking of, like a bridge over...
No, I know what you're talking about. It's like a little overpass,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, like it's...
It goes over train tracks, actually.
Yeah, and it's so dumb, but technically I was on the part of the road where it started to turn into a bridge, even though it just looked like a normal sidewalk. There's literally storefronts to your, you know, to your side.
Okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start a GoFundMe for you so we can have HTM listeners help crowdsource the payment of this ticket.
It's totally fine. I've already paid it, but honestly, this kind of makes me think of a conversation you and I were having recently about risking it, right? When it comes to parking, a lot of times you either fall maybe on one end of the spectrum or the other. You're either a very rule-following, law-abiding citizen, or you can be more like you, which Which you park places illegally all the time.
Well, I don't know if I would say all the time. My mom listens to the show. Please comment down over there.
I've seen you do it.
But I recently did go to meet a friend for beers downtown by the airport, and I met him at his hotel. There's no other place to park except for in the parking deck of this hotel, and it was $18 an hour for 1 hour to park there. And I was like, the beer's going to cost $6, and like this parking is, I couldn't do it. And so there were some empty spaces. It was a rainy night. There were some empty spaces, I guess, where they do the valet parking, but there was no valet in sight. And so I was like, you know what? I'm only going to be here for an hour and a half, having a beer with my friend. I'm going to chance it. And yes, I did it. I broke the rules, but I ended up not having to pay that $18 an hour parking.
You lucked out. Whereas I didn't. I mean, I think this is a good conversation to have, because what we're talking about here is risk. And in our lives, every single day, we assume certain risks, whether or not they are perceived risks or whether they're just fears in our head. And I think it's important for us just to kind of weigh the consequences that we might receive from that action. And then from there, make the best decision, right? So for me, if this was a lot that said, towing enforced, you will be towed to whatever, you know, giant tow lot. But that's a much bigger hassle. That is a much bigger expense. And I would, if I saw that, I would have been like, okay, it's not marked very clearly.
Not worth the chance.
But I see that tow sign. I am not willing to take that risk. But knowing that Park Atlanta sometimes is out and they write these little dumb tickets. And again, normally I would have ridden my bike to that Atlanta United match.
Right.
The fact that I had driven, I was like, well, to even pay to park at a nearby lot sometimes costs $15 or $20. And so in my mind, I thought, you know what? This is a great little spot right here. We can just hop over. And in this case, it costs us a little bit more than it would have otherwise. But it was a risk I was willing to take.
There you go. Especially if you're going in for just a quick pit stop. Sometimes that's a risk I'm willing to take.
Sure.
But I'm not nearly as much of a delinquent as you made me sound. I just want people to know that. But all right, let's keep moving on.
For the record, Mom.
Clearing my name. But let's mention the beer that we're having real quick, Matt. Today we're drinking Southern Crisp from Southern Grist Brewing. And it's this is a Pilsner. This is a great brewery out of Nashville. And we've had a couple of their beers on the show before, but it's time to have another one. So we'll give our thoughts on this one at the end of the episode.
We will.
But let's get on to listener questions, Matt. And for folks out there who want to submit a question for a future Ask HTM episode, just go to howtomoney.com/ask. There are simple instructions there. It'll take you just like 30 seconds to record your questions, send it over, and Matt and I, we'd love to answer it on an upcoming episode. But this first one is that question that Matt mentioned about investing and saving too much of your money.
Hey, Joel and Matt. It's Jason in Rochester, New York. I've got a question about my retirement savings. Whenever I ask somebody, like a financial advisor, I never seem to get a clear answer. It's always subjective in some way. Interested in seeing what your perspective is. I know that on your show, a few times you've mentioned that having, you know, $1 million, $1.5 million, something like that when you retire is good enough for most people. I'm currently 37 years old. I make about, you know, $110,000 a year. I'm currently debt-free other than my house. My 401k is right at about $245,000 right now, and I'm putting in about 9% with a 5% match from my employer. If I look at the projections, it tells me that I'm going to be somewhere in the range of $2.5 to $3 million when I'm ready to retire. However, I've never maxed out my 401k contribution, and all I hear is you must do that if you can. So what's the balance between lifestyle and making sure that you're aggressively saving so you have enough?
All right, Jason, thanks for that question. And you know, you talking about speaking with different financial advisors makes Joel and I both think of this classic quote from Upton Sinclair, which is, it is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it.
That explains a whole lot about this world.
Yeah. When you're speaking to a financial advisor, even ones who are really good at their job, it's just going to be close to impossible to get an answer that doesn't involve invest more money. Do the responsible thing. Do the thing that we're going to tell you to do.
Especially if they're charging a fee for assets under management. They're like, of course, investing more is the best way to go.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, of course, generally speaking, like investing more, like that is a really smart move. And it's often in the best interest of not only yourself, but also the financial advisor as well. But there is just more to consider than just investing as much as humanly possible.
Right. Do we want to acquire Warren Buffett levels of wealth? Like, is that our goal? And to still go to McDonald's for the biscuit every morning that he gets or whatever? Like, maybe that is your goal. And that's okay, I guess. But that's not our goal, Matt. Like, we don't want that kind of money with that sort of like austere lifestyle that Warren Buffett lives.
Although going out to eat for breakfast every morning sounds kind of fancy.
That does sound
kind of fancy. It's just the fact that it's at McDonald's,
right.
Which also, like, who is this guy's doctor? Like, like, I want to know the cardiologist that's like, yeah, man, keep it up. Like, you seem to be doing all right.
Hey, he made it to 91. So
I guess so. So
whatever he's doing is working.
Can't knock it.
Right. But yeah, the actual amount of money, Jason, that you're going to want to have saved up when it comes to retirement time depends on so many different factors. You mentioned a million or a million and a half. Well, for some people, $1 million in retirement sounds like an impossible task. Like, I'll never be able to hit that. That's too big of a goal. And then for other people, that wouldn't be nearly enough to afford the lifestyle that they want to live when it comes to retirement, especially if they're one of those people that wants to retire early, like in their 40s, right? They're going to need, in all likelihood, more money than that in order to be able to make that possible. So it really is just hard to come up with a lump sum rule of thumb for those non-working decades. There's just too many individually specific factors that we can't all take into account, and you have to actually really do it on an individual basis. But I would say, anyone telling you that you must max out your 401k or that you're not doing it right if you're not doing that, they're putting too much emphasis on the future and not enough on the here and now. Maybe that's a good thing for you, but it sounds like it also might not be the best thing for you.
Yeah, for some folks, maxing out retirement accounts, like, that actually is the best move. Like, we've got no problem with max savers funneling as much of their income as they can towards tax-advantaged accounts. But it is possible for some in that crowd, and specifically we're thinking about the financial independence retire early folks, and oftentimes they can go too far. They've just focused so much on building up a massive stockpile in those retirement accounts that they just neglect some of the important things that money can be used for now. They're too focused on the later and not focused enough on the now. They might continue working, say, in a job that they don't like for years longer than they should, or maybe they might refuse to spend money that would just boost their own happiness of themselves and of their family. And so for those folks, I think oversaving is actually a real problem for some individuals. Building wealth, it's important and it's totally smart, but maximizing those investments far beyond your needs doesn't win you extra bonus points. At that point, you're just building wealth for wealth's sake. You're not really thinking about what you want life to look like.
Yeah, there's a book, Matt, called Die with Zero. And his whole goal is to get people to not think about, like, leaving millions behind to your kids. Like, is that really the point of what you're trying to do with your life? Is to and it's an interesting concept, the concept of dying with zero as opposed to dying with millions of dollars in the bank. It's worth thinking about. But let's talk about Jason's position in particular. Jason, you're in a great position. You know, most listeners probably heard what you said in your question, and they were a bit envious of your financial position,
yeah.
Right? You know, being debt-free, Matt, that's with only a mortgage. That's a great place to be in. A lot of our listeners are dealing with other sorts of debt, some pesky credit card debt that's hanging around.
Student loans,
yeah. For sure. And Jason's already built up an excellent sum of money for the future that's going to continue to work on his behalf without him having to do much, without him having to even really pay attention to it. And the cool thing is, Jason, that you're still putting 14% of your salary in because of that generous match that your employer offers. That's right in the range that we love to see for folks. And since you're in money year 7, there's just so much flexibility for you. You know, we always say, and Matt and I think one of the key tenets of personal finance is that delayed gratification is of utmost importance. But you've got that down. Your next task really is to push for balance in your life. So we would just suggest that you get intentional and find ways to incorporate a little more of the money that you're making now into a fulfilling life, like in the here and now, not just prioritizing, not over prioritizing your future self.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's how you strike that balance. So much of this question comes down to individual goals and, Jason, what you want your life to look like. And so some questions maybe to ask yourself, like, do you like your work? Like, do you like the actual job that you have currently? In a perfect world, would you still be working in that job or within that industry in 20 years. Instead, if you want to start your own business, or maybe you have dreams of doing some work that pays maybe quite a bit less in the near future, then you might want to ratchet up your savings. But that being said, if you aren't planning to make any big changes in your life, it sounds like that you're doing just fine. Either way, you're quite a ways down the path towards financial independence. Don't pay too much attention to the folks who are just encouraging and goading you on to invest more. You can do it if you want, but there's no financial necessity for you to do so.
Yeah, and going back to one of the things that Jason said earlier in his question too, that we have to respond to, I mean, it really is tough to know an exact dollar amount to make sure that you're investing that much for the future. But there is a good rule of thumb, I think, and that is to have 25 times your annual expenses saved and invested for the future. So for instance, if you did have $1 million net worth, you know, in investments, you could withdraw $40,000 a year every single year, and you're highly unlikely to outlive the money that you have saved. And this rule of thumb, it's called the 4% rule, and it comes from the Trinity study that's often cited. But basically, it just shows that it ran like a bunch of different scenarios about how the stock market has performed across the decades. And if you go by that rule, you are highly unlikely to run out of money for the 30-year period after you retire, right? As long as you have that 25 times your annual expenses set aside. So crunch your numbers, see if you're on track to achieve that. Jason, it sounds like you're more than on track to achieve that in all likelihood. But that's a good place to start. That's a good rule of thumb to consider. You're at least then aiming at a target, right? You might not be hitting the exact center of the target, but you're going to be close enough.
Yeah. And what's so great about that too is it's dependent on your own spending. And so whereas somebody might say just a dollar amount, well, who the heck knows? Like, you don't know what my life looks like.
Right.
Like, you don't know the different things.
You don't know how many parking tickets and how much money that's going to cost Matt, how much he's racking up.
You know how many times I have to pay to get my car back from the tow lot? Those are all things you have to count in your budget.
And they're very personal.
And so, Jason, for you to look at how much you're spending every year, that will allow you to, I mean, get really dang close if you can just forecast and look ahead a little bit and know what you're likely to spend. One of the numbers you said too was $2.5 million. Well, if you do the reverse math, that's $100,000 a year in expenses. And so maybe your projections are pretty spot on. It all depends on what life looks like for you, what life costs, and from there you can make those changes.
No doubt. All right, well, let's get to some more listener questions, Matt, including the Warehouse Club showdown, Sam's Club versus Costco. We'll get to that and more right after this break.
All right, we are back, and we've got a question about an old 401k with a previous employer. We'll get to that one here in a second, but first, let's talk about warehouse clubs.
Hello, this is James from Champaign, Illinois. In Champaign, we happen to have a Sam's Club and a Costco. I was curious if you had a recommendation on which one to join. I look forward to listening to your podcast every week and look forward to hearing your recommendation. Thanks.
Matt, these are the kind of Champaign problems that exist in our world. When you live in Champaign, Illinois, you have just a plethora of options at your disposal.
How did I know you were going to do that?
Because dad jokes are strong with me. Yeah. And I just want James to know I, too, like to go clubbing from time to time, mostly at the Costco. But this is a great question. And yeah, like warehouse clubs, Matt, it's important to note, and bulk buying, they're not for everyone. We've talked about warehouse clubs before on the show. Mostly me, are fans of Costco.
Hey, I like Costco.
Yeah, you do. You're kind of coming around on it recently. And yeah, we go typically once a month, once every 3 weeks to stock up on some stuff. Some folks just don't have a large enough family to make it make sense, or they don't have enough space to store, you know, 39 or 82 pieces, rolls of toilet paper. So really, you know, it depends on your lifestyle. But to let you know up front, James, I am biased on this one. Even though I have been a Sam's Club member in the past, I'm currently a Costco member and have been for quite some time. We'll do our best to give you a nuanced answer of, you know, when each one makes sense and maybe what the pros and cons are to Sam's versus Costco. I'm just going to let you know up front, I'm biased.
Kind of goes back to the Upton Sinclair quote at the beginning of the episode.
Although Costco does not in any way pay me any money, so.
That is true. James, one of the initial upfront aspects of the warehouse clubs that's easy to compare is the cost of membership. And so let's talk about that for a second. Sam's Club, it's only $45 for their club membership, whereas Costco, they charge $60 for their Gold Star membership. And so while we do like to save money right from the get-go, I wouldn't let the tiny difference in membership fee be the deciding factor here. And actually, while we're talking about numbers, another kind of clear and easy comparison is the cash back bonus that their credit cards pay. Each of those clubs has a credit card associated with your membership. And specifically...
Which you don't have to get if you don't want.
Yeah, you don't have to. But, I mean, why wouldn't you? Because specifically on gas, it can make a ton of sense. Costco's Anywhere Visa, they pay 4%, whereas the Sam's Club MasterCard pays 5%
on all gas
on
purchases.
Gas. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And so
if you've got an EV, you don't care.
That's true. But I mention that because if you know that you'll always get gas at one of the warehouse clubs, then being aware of that credit card benefit, it's important. It just depends a lot on what you're purchasing from the warehouses. You want to make sure that you keep that in mind because it's not all about the numbers. You have to take some other things into account as well.
True. Yeah. One of the reasons we can't only consider just the fees and the cash back is because it's difficult to quantify so much of what these warehouses have to offer. For instance, prices are on average just a bit lower at Costco than they are at Sam's. And a lot of that comes down to the fact that Sam's tends to carry more name brand items.
Right.
So if you are kind of a name brand person, you might tend to like Sam's Club more because of that. But one of the big check marks I would say in favor of Costco is that they have quite a bit of Kirkland Signature products, which is their own store brand. And those store brand items tend to consistently rate well and get good reviews. In fact, Costco has this standard, Matt, I'm not sure if you know about this, but they say that anytime they put Kirkland Signature on an item, they want it to be at least a little bit better than the name brand item. And I will say, I have found that to be true.
Yeah, that's pretty high standard.
It is. Like that Kirkland Signature jelly, whatever they're doing to it, keep doing it because it's delicious. I'll say that. But yeah, they consistently meet that standard. And of course, that usually means that it's a more affordable item too. So it goes to show it's just hard to put a number on quality. And the quality that you perceive really so much depends on kind of what you're interested in, the kind of things that you shop for when you go to those warehouse clubs, and whether you care about name brands or store brands or any of that stuff.
That's true. It's tough to quantify quality. And what you're saying is Costco's got that quality. And I think one of the other things to keep in mind when you're considering going between Costco or Sam's Club is to basically consider which one is closer to where you live or you know, which one is more convenient maybe to where you work. So you kind of mentioned how we joined Costco, Joel, and how we're kind of coming around. So we joined Costco several months ago in order to take advantage of a mortgage refinance deal that they had going on. And that alone was well worth the cost of joining. But here's the thing, man. We still haven't made it out to a Costco here in Atlanta because it's so far away. We've only shopped at one while we were on a trip out of town. I actually haven't been to my quote-unquote local Costco because in my book, it's not local. It's too far away. And so it doesn't matter how great the products are if you're never going to take advantage of that membership.
Although you can still shop online. And so as a Costco member, like I didn't want to go up there to pick up a pack of diapers.
Yeah.
But it was the same price, I think, online as it was in store.
You think?
Pretty sure.
Okay. The prices online are more expensive.
Exactly. They are. Sometimes they are. You're right. And so I bought diapers online, had them shipped to my door. And even if it was a dollar or two more, I know they were really close. I'm pretty sure they were the same. If you were grilling me, though, I couldn't swear 100% that it was,
right.
But I'm pretty sure it was. And so, yeah, I got those diapers shipped to the house, and it was really convenient. I think another thing that James should consider is maybe being a member at both. And that might sound a little crazy, especially
when you live in Champaign, Illinois. Maybe you can afford both clubs.
Exactly. Maybe James has those Champaign tastes and has the budget to back it up. But yeah, it really does work for some folks who really like both stores. And Sam's Club has actually, you know, one thing in their favor. They've made it easier than ever to shop on their website and save with free shipping for Plus members on a ton of items. So let's say Sam's Club wasn't as close, wasn't as convenient, but shopping online works for you. Well, they've made it pretty great and pretty easy to get stuff shipped to your door for free. And the great thing about either one of these memberships, Matt, is if that at any point you decide you're not getting enough value from it, well, either Costco or Sam's Club will refund the fees that you paid for that membership.
Right, yeah.
And with no questions asked. They're not going to like grill you and be like, excuse me, sir.
Fill out this form.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really in their best interest. Like, they want to wow you. They want to make you happy. And if you're not happy, you just ask for your money back and they say, okay. So even if you're on day like 364 of your membership cycle, that's probably not like a kosher way to go.
Kind of a jerk move.
Not the coolest thing to do. But you still can cancel and get the membership fees refunded to you. So I would say because of that, James has nothing to lose. Like, give both a shot and then decide after which one works best into, you know, most convenient for you, which one fits your shopping habits best. And you might find that keeping both makes the most sense to you, or you might find, you know what, now clearly I want to ditch this one and go with the other.
Yeah, exactly. It can be difficult to determine what is worth it to you, right? Because you can crunch the numbers on Sam's Club jelly or the name brand jelly, if that's what they are carrying there, versus the Costco jelly like Joel talks about. But if you actually try it and you don't care and there isn't a difference, it can be so difficult to quantify that quality. And a lot of times you have to experience it in order to see if it's worth the money. And Joel, actually, this kind of makes me think too, what's keeping me from canceling my Costco membership? Because I did that refi.
Nothing.
And if I'm not actually gaining any value from that, I mean, that might be something that we actually do. Although that Costco Anywhere Visa, I might be tempted to sign up for that just for the rewards, just for that cash back on gas purchases alone. Might be worth it for me.
But. Yeah, and I love that both of those warehouse clubs make that a thing. It's like, hey, if you're not satisfied, come on back. I love any retailer that stands behind the products that they sell, that stands behind their membership like that. REI does very much the same thing. And if you're like, hey, I don't like this item that I bought, their return policy is incredibly generous. And any place that prioritizes their customers to that extent is a place that I want to shop.
So, totally. That's right.
Well, let's keep moving on, Matt. Let's get to our next question. This one is about what to do with an old 401k that you're hanging on to.
Hey, Joel and Matt. This is Amanda from Cincinnati, Ohio. First off, I just want to say that I love your podcast, as it was the first money podcast that I was truly able to understand and stick with throughout my financial journey. So thank you for everything that you do. I recently had a daughter and have switched jobs. I have a 401k from my previous employer with about $18,000 in it at Fidelity. My question is that I have already rolled over one of my previous 401ks to an IRA with Vanguard. I would love to keep one account at Fidelity and one at Vanguard, but I'm not sure what to do with this 401k to make sure that I keep it growing. Do I transfer it to another type of retirement account, and what type, since I already have an IRA? Do I leave it a 401k and continue to fund it? I do have a 401k at my new job as well. For reference, I made about $120,000 last year, married but filing separate. So I'm not sure if I can have a Roth IRA account. Thank you so much for all of your help. It's allowing me to financially set up a stable future for my daughter.
Hey, Amanda, thanks so much for that question and those comments as well. We appreciate you listening to the show. There are a lot of other great personal finance shows out there, but many, they do have a too much jargon problem. We try to keep our jargon usage to a minimum.
When you do want to come up with some crazy piece of financial jargon, though, what do you go to, Matt? Do you have one?
I don't have one on top of my mind.
Okay. So I'll tell you one that I hate. I think it's just the way it sounds. Pay yourself first. I love the concept of saving.
That's not jargon. That's just like a nice informative phrase.
I don't know. It's not
like jargon, like are like the kind of fancy phrases or terms that don't translate to real English.
Okay,
right? Like that's the like technical jargon, like an ESOP or something like that. Like, and that's, I mean, acronyms are fine as long as you take the time to explain what they stand for.
Although we did get an email from a listener who was like, he said, I didn't know what an IPA was. I had to look it up. You guys should really explain that in the future. And we drink a lot of IPAs. I don't want to explain it every time, but maybe we should.
An India Pale Ale.
We're using beer jargon, but not financial jargon.
Well, that's what's less important. We want to make sure that we explain the finances, and the beer talk is just there for kicks. But Amanda, I wanted to say congrats, too, on your baby girl. That's an awesome thing to celebrate. But let's go ahead and get to your question. You've got your accounts at the best possible places, both at Fidelity and Vanguard, and so that's pretty amazing. I love the idea of keeping those in place and actually doing business with both companies. And so since your 401k is already at a low-cost institution, I'd just leave it as is. You mentioned continuing to fund that 401k, however, but that is not something that you can do since you are no longer employed there. But you can continue to manage that account. Just make sure that you don't forget that it exists. you don't want to like misplace $18,000 and realize, oh, wait a minute, I had that sitting at this account that I no longer have the login info for.
That's worse than a parking ticket. Yeah. Right? I'm going to keep bringing it up as often as I can today. All right.
$25, man. No biggie.
And let's continue on, though. And again, Amanda, the reason that we would suggest that you leave your 401k with Fidelity is because Fidelity is such a great company with low to no fees. There are a few companies like that that kind of fit our guidelines for greatness, but Fidelity is definitely one of those few. So yeah, if you had come to us and you're with a high cost company that had terrible investing options, that had expense ratios out the roof, then we would most definitely recommend moving on and rolling your money over into a company like Fidelity or Vanguard, who you're currently with. If that's the boat you're in, we would recommend you either doing that or doing a direct transfer to your new employer's 401k if they allow it. But so much of that depends on whether the new employer that you're with is using a high-cost 401k provider or one of the low-cost ones that you mentioned. And if they were doing business with one of the high-cost 401k providers, then we'd recommend another 401k to IRA rollover similar to what you've already done.
That's right. And yeah, so leave that 401k put since you're already with Fidelity. And remember, again, you can't continue to contribute to that old 401k, but of course you can contribute quite a bit, up to $19,500 each year to the new 401k that you have with your current employer. But to answer another part of your question, you asked about transferring that 401k balance to another type of retirement account and converting it to a Roth IRA. That actually is an option for you. And that's because there are income limits placed on your ability to contribute to a Roth IRA in the kind of classic sense. But those income limits, they don't apply to a 401k conversion. And so that means that you can actually be a really high earner and still contribute to a Roth IRA via a rollover. Again, money that you've contributed to a 401k is pre-tax money. And so when you make that traditional to Roth conversion, you're going to owe some taxes on that money. So be prepared for that. But diversifying your tax liability down the road, that's a good strategy, especially if you're expecting to continue to earn a higher salary down the road. And so for you to convert some of this money, that would be a good way for you to diversify that tax liability.
Yeah, but again, it's really important to make sure that you have the money on hand to pay that tax bill that comes due, because there will be one. And you can kind of figure out based on how much you're converting and what tax bracket you're in, you know, what that likely amount is going to be. You can get it within the ballpark for sure pretty easily. So make sure you're saving for that. But Amanda, that was a great question, and best of luck to you moving forward, you and your baby girl. All right, we've got a couple more questions to get to, including house hacking. Is that a good pursuit? Is that better than maybe other types of investing? We'll tackle that and more right after this.
All right, we are back, and we've got a couple more questions we're going to get to during this episode, including this one from a listener who has a few questions about emergency funds.
Hi, Matt and Joel. This is Ben from Denver, and I just started listening to your podcast, and I've already learned quite a bit and really appreciate your advice. I had a three-part question, so just bear with me. First, what would you say is a safe amount of money to have in a savings account for emergency situations while also not having too much to the point where it could be used somewhere else where it might be earning more interest? Second, from what I've been reading, it might be better to put our emergency fund in some kind of other higher interest earning savings account rather than just the money market account we currently have it in at our credit union, which has a fairly low interest rate. Do you have any recommendations for higher interest earning accounts for our emergency fund? And then lastly, is there any kind of short-term investment that you would recommend that's low risk but has a high return for quickly saving a little cash for something like a home improvement project? We're looking at getting a deck built in our backyard in the next 2 to 3 months. And I was just wondering if there was a short-term investment that's more productive than just having our money sitting in a savings account, or if that's just a unicorn. Thanks for your advice and keep doing what you're doing.
Ben, so glad to have you as a listener. Thank you for your question. Let's get into it, Matt. Let's talk emergency funds. It's one of your favorite topics, I know.
Dude, I love emergency funds.
I know. They're helpful, right?
I thought you were making fun of me.
Well, I like to do that.
A lot of ragging going on in this episode. I thought you were like ragging my love for emergency funds.
Well, I know your emergency fund took a hit with that parking ticket that you recently had to pay.
Please.
But let's dive deep for a second. 3 months is a great first goal to have when it comes to an e-fund. Well, even before that, you know, you and I, we've suggested, Matt, $2,467 as being at least the initial amount you should strive for.
That's the beginner's emergency fund.
Exactly. So then 3 months is another great goal.
Yeah.
And then 6 months is another reasonable goal to have for many people. Which one you're aiming for depends, though, on your particular circumstances. Are you dual income? Like, how much does that income fluctuate? Would you say that your job is stable? Because you can't always predict a job loss, but you probably have a good idea about how good of a position that your employer is in. And based on your history there, you probably have a good idea about what your future looks like there. It's not something we can predict with 100% accuracy, but the answers to all those questions will help point you in the right direction when it comes to how big of an emergency fund you're really trying to amass. The greater level of stability that you have financially and income-wise, the more comfortable you should feel having a little bit less in that e-fund, but still somewhere between 3 and 6 months of expenses is the right goal, I would say, for most people.
That's right. And it is possible to have too much money within an emergency fund. We talked about that actually just a bit in response to Jason's question, although his was about having too much in investments. But there's just this risk of being, you know, too good of a saver and then not allowing your money to work for you because you're being too conservative with that money. We feel that it is important to take risk with your money, and the stats show that it's a particularly awful time right now to be a saver. Having liquid cash is crucial. It always has been. It always will be. But having too much cash, that can be harmful over the long term. So much of it depends on your personal situation, just like Joel said, specifically how dependable your income is, how for sure your job is going to be. But you also have to weigh that with how comfortable you feel having less cash in the bank.
Yeah, Matt, you mentioned that it's a particularly awful time to be a saver right now. And we talked about that recently on the show, but just the fact that there, one, low savings rates, and then two, inflation going up, it just means that your money in savings is having a harder time right now.
Yeah.
And so it's you need to have more exposure to the market in order to make sure that your money isn't slowly, and actually right now, a little more quickly, being just eroded, the purchasing power being eroded from your savings.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a perfect storm right now for savers to see more of their money eroded by inflation because they're not getting paid anything with it, you know, stashed away in a savings account.
Yeah, and that doesn't mean that it's not important, because we just mentioned 3 to 6 months, still very important. Liquid cash is important for so many things, including short-term expenses and including being prepared for potential emergencies. Also, Ben, you mentioned having your savings at your credit union. Matt and I, we love credit unions. I believe we dedicated an entire episode to how great they are. And here's the thing. One of the places where credit unions aren't so great is that they don't pay the best rate for savers compared to some of the online banks. So that's where we would suggest that you put your money for parking e-fund cash. You can expect to earn 0.5%, maybe even a little more with some of the solid online banks. And then your money is also fully FDIC insured. It's still insured to the credit union, but just know that you're going to get paid a higher rate if you prioritize one of the online banks as opposed to keeping your money in savings at the credit union. There are always new online banks popping up promising just more and more benefits, but you got to be careful with some of those, some of the neobanks. And Matt actually just opened an account with one of these newer online banks that's promising higher returns. He's going to see if it's legit and get a feel for their customer service. We'll let you know how it goes.
We're not even going to say what bank it is because we want to vet it basically before we start talking about it.
Yeah, but we have other online banks we could point you to already. Ally, Discover, CIT, those are three that we mentioned consistently. There are other good ones too, but make sure that your money is not earning 0.01%. Make sure it's earning at least 0.5%.
And then Ben, you talked about wanting to grow that money at a more rapid pace. Everybody wants to accelerate the growth of their money while taking on little to no risk, but that just doesn't exist. We have talked about I-bonds here on the show. Those are great for small amounts of cash that you have that you don't want to get torched by inflation. But if you need that money within the next 12 months, I-bonds won't work for you, because you talked about needing that money within maybe a month or two. Could we interest you in this new crypto coin that Joel and I are going to mint? You might see your money go up there, but that is pure speculation, and you could very well see your money disappear just as easily. And so, yeah, you asked if something like that might be a unicorn, and we would have to agree. Yeah, earning a great return on short-term money with no risk, you're definitely entering that unicorn territory at that point.
Yeah, good luck trying to find that product, because it doesn't really exist. Like, yep. It's just not possible. And that's how a lot of people have gotten scammed over the years, being promised something that was going to pay mega returns on a short timeline. It sounds really good, but it's too good to be true. All right, let's get to our last question of this episode, Matt. And this one is about investing less in order to pursue house hacking.
Hello, my name is Jake and I am 22 and live in the Atlanta area. My question is about house hacking and retirement contributions. I currently have no debt, 3 months expenses saved in a high yield savings account, and I'm contributing 24% of my gross income to retirement accounts each month by maxing out my HSA, Roth IRA, and putting 10% in my employer's Roth 401k plan. However, after some researching, reading, and listening to several podcasts, I've decided that I think that real estate investing is a good option for me, and I would like to start by house hacking. I know that real estate investing would require a decent amount of capital on hand in cash, but I am finding it hard to save beyond 24% given my current housing expense. I know that you encourage listeners to save 15%, Clark Howard encourages 20%, and another financial podcast I enjoy encourages 25%. My question to you, is it worth it decreasing the amount I save in my retirement accounts in order to have more cash to buy my first property? I expect to save significantly over my current renting situation even after expenses. I look forward to your thoughts. Thanks.
All right. Hopefully Ben's still listening because Jake, he's got that 3 month emergency fund set up, which is, yeah, like we said earlier, a great place to start.
Yeah.
And on top of that, Jake's crushing it in basically every other way when it comes to his personal finances. So Jake, good job. But let's go ahead and we'll kind of give you the quick short answer to your question. And we feel that you should most definitely consider devoting more of your savings towards real estate as opposed to investing that in the market.
Oh yeah.
Specifically, I mean, overall, the thing that's going on here is that he's talking about taking that money and investing it. He's not talking about taking that money and consuming it, right? Because if he were talking about, say, taking that money and buying a fancy boat or something like that, that would be a completely different story. But the fact that he's talking about putting this in real estate, we think is a really smart move. And another reason too is it's just obvious how intentional that Jake is being with his money. Jake, you're not making this decision lightly, and it sounds like you've done your due diligence by kind of reading and listening to others on the topic. And so that doesn't necessarily mean that you should buy a house tomorrow, but you should definitely start heading in that direction. There are a lot of folks out there who just like the idea of house hacking, or maybe, you know, they've watched a couple videos, but it sounds like that you've done enough digging to know the pros and cons. You've thought about it enough to realize too that this isn't just another form of passive investing. You're talking about taking on this lifestyle change, and that's another thing to keep in mind as well, because if you're down for this change, then this is something that you're going to excel at. I think if folks are looking for comparing apples to apples, well, investing in the market and real estate, it's not apples to apples, but it sounds like you are all about switching up your lifestyle a little bit in order to facilitate seeing a higher return on your money.
Yeah, and you mentioned that Jake shouldn't go out there and buy a boat, like decrease, you know, what he's putting away for retirement and buy a boat. But what if he was going to rent that boat out on the equivalent of Turo? I'm sure there's something like that exists for boats. And if that's the case, Jake, I'm all for it. but no, let's keep talking about house hacking. You know, since housing is the number one line item in almost everybody's budget, Matt, that is a huge reason why house hacking is so great. I think it's one of the best moves that people who want to get their personal finances in order can make. The great thing about house hacking is that it can lower those pesky housing costs that you mentioned. And in some cases, it can get better than that. You know, some savvy investors, Jake, who are living in like a quadplex, which is four units, they're getting paid to do that. They rent out three of the units and they live rent-free. You know, being able to dedicate less of your take-home pay to putting a roof over your head is a game changer when it comes to accelerating your ability to save and invest more down the road. I don't know, Matt, of any other single personal finance move that's as big of a game changer as house hacking can be and is for so many people.
That's right. So Jake, now that you have our blessing, you've got our permission, let's talk about what your next steps might be. Go ahead, dial back those retirement contributions and then create a separate savings account, or at least kind of having some separate savings buckets within a single account that is dedicated to saving up that down payment that you'll need to buy a house. Do some research on specific neighborhoods that you think would be a good target for you. Then get a great real estate agent. And then together, we want you to kind of stalk those listings. We want you to be so familiar with specific properties, with specific streets within neighborhoods that you're going to know when you see a deal. Because when you see a deal, that's when you're going to want to counts. You want to be able to move quickly on a property that meets your parameters. And keep in mind as well, oftentimes you'll read how a multifamily house, how the numbers are going to work out best from that standpoint. But keep in mind that a single family home, that might actually work just as well if you're okay living in close quarters, renting out rooms within that house, especially if you have folks who are maybe a similar age, you're in a similar life stage, and that's something that you're all down to do together. Again, keep in mind that it might partly come down not just to what the numbers are saying, but whether or not this makes sense for you from a lifestyle standpoint.
No doubt. And Jake, getting going in this direction early, it can really be like a catapult, you know, just slinging you towards financial independence at a really early age, giving you a whole lot of flexibility when it comes to the house you want to live in. If you decide to start a family someday, like if you do decide that you want more room, there's just so much benefit that you can get, that you can derive from house hacking early on. And so, yeah, best of luck to you as you pursue this route. It sounds like you've done your due diligence and that you're going to crush it. So
yeah, you said catapult, Joel. It makes me think of like on Mario Kart when it's counting down the lights, and if you mash A and B between lights
right
2
time.
And 3, like you get that turbo right off the line. Jake, we feel that you starting to house hack is going to get you off that line in a serious way. You're going to be in the lead, at least at the beginning. You know, Princess might come up behind you and take you down.
Throw a shell at you.
But off the line, this is going to be a serious boost to your personal finances.
No doubt. All right, let's get back to the beer that we had on the show, Matt. This one is called Southern Crisp by Southern Grist. It's a Pilsner-style lager. What were your thoughts on this beer?
Man, this is a thirst-quenching beer. that's all I can think of with this beer.
Definitely a classic lawnmower beer.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Like, I can't think of any more. Like, it's just a classic. Like, it makes me think of, like, Homer Simpson. This is what he was drinking when he's sitting there at Moe's. Like, this is just
this
the quintessential.
Duff equivalent.
Yes, this is just, like, the quintessential classic beer. Really refreshing, easy to drink, thirst-quenching, like you said. But just a beautiful gold color. I always like it when they coordinate the color of the label with the color of the beer. This is totally one of those beers that I've done that. Like the label of this beer is just like a beautiful golden color, and that's totally what they got going on inside the glass as well. But yeah, really enjoyed it, man. How about you?
Yeah, me too. Now, when you think about what a beer tastes like, your assumption would be that it tastes like this beer, honestly.
Yeah.
And there are really bad styles of this, and most of us have gotten used to drinking those kinds. Drinking, you know, Miller or Bud, you know, the macro beers, the macro pilsners that just taste. They're not good. They're just not good. I feel like this beer is what those styles were meant to be and should be. This is like finely crafted and tastes delicious. It's a style of beer I find myself surprisingly drinking more of, more drawn to. And this particular variety is one that I'm going to pick up again because Southern Grist is just making really, really good beers. And I like this one a lot.
That's true. Yeah, we really like heavily hopped IPAs, we really like barrel-aged
pale ales for folks that don't know. Yep.
Less jargon, of course, for everyone out there. Or like massively fruited sours. All of these beers are great and we enjoy them. But it's also nice from time to time to not have a beer that just completely busts you over the head. Like this is the kind of beer you want to enjoy while you're eating some pizza, that kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
It's just a nice table beer that you can enjoy with pretty much anything. Definitely a beer that you can enjoy while listening to How to Money. And on that note, that's going to be it for this episode. Listeners can find our show notes up on our website at howtomoney.com. We'll make sure to link to any resources that we may have mentioned during this episode.
No doubt. And if you haven't had a chance to leave a review for our show, we would really appreciate it if you hopped over to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen, took a few seconds to write a nice note about, you know, how the show has helped you out. It helps other listeners know what they're getting into ahead of time and hopefully choose to listen to this show so that they can make better decisions, better moves with their money going forward. So, all right, that's going to do it. Until next time, best friends out.
Best friends out.